Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. We're going to be discussing climate change and environment and environmental ethics with philosopher Matt Goodwin, who's a professor up at NAU. What do you think, Mike? This is a topic we've never done before.
Well, Mike Costantino says that philosophy is one of those things that's easy to poke fun at, six philosophers go into a bar and whatever. But the idea is that I was teasing Matt before the show about environment ethics. This country has, at least this country, has no environment. Maybe in Sweden or Norway or someone, they have what we're talking, the topic this morning, environmental ethics. This is an oxymoron. This is like military intelligence. But hopefully Matt is going to change our minds.
At least
my mind.
Environmental ethics gets going in philosophy as a department in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. When I studied philosophy, there was no topic. There was moral philosophy and ethics, and we did all that. But we had no separate course or program about environmental ethics, Matt.
Right. And thanks for having me on here, Steve and Mike. You're right that historically philosophy has focused mainly on moral issues between two people or more. And typically we only think of ethics as coming about when somebody is being harmed. That I think is primarily the Western European tradition that you were taught when we teach ethics in that way. But if you look in the United States, clearly in the Americas, the indigenous cultures already had a very robust environmental ethics, just was never identified as something that was unique. It becomes a unique thing in the 60s and 70s in the United States as we become more conscious and aware of the harms that we're doing through nature itself. But then we also have people like Aldo Leopold a little bit earlier in the 40s and 50s was already talking about describing an ethic of the land, that we have a responsibility to the land as a biotic community, that we are a member of this biotic community. And this, I think, actually really well articulates a lot of indigenous cultures' views, but it brings it up to speed for the European worldviews.
I guess the question, Matt, is you know, when I was growing up, in hunting, hunters had a whole lot of rules about what you could do and what you couldn't. I mean, there were always poachers and stuff out there hunting deer off season and stuff. But there are all kinds of rules. But the rules to protect the deer population were functional, right? So that there'd be more deer to hunt. What's the difference between the kind of functional ethics, like instrumental ethics, I'm trying to achieve a certain goal. If we harvest all the fish in the ocean, then we don't have any more fish to harvest. If we hunt the forest out, then there's no more food. And so for quite a while, people have been working on a kind of instrumental or practical results-oriented kind of philosophy about nature, but you're talking about something a little different, right?
Right. So I do think that what you're describing is kind of like a conservation worldview of trying to conserve a resource so that it's available for us long term. And I actually do think, though, in the hunting ethic, there is, I think, among hunters a very keen awareness of a sense of responsibility and rightness and wrongness that goes beyond, I think, just conservation for future use. You see this in Aldo Leopold again, where he himself was a hunter and would hunt the wolves, who he saw as predators, that he saw as affecting the game that people wanted to hunt and use as food. But he came to a realization at one point that there was an intrinsic goodness of the wolf and importance of its being there. And it wasn't just in terms of a conservation for future resources.
Well, there were all kinds of rules that seemed to have an ethical basis, Matt. Maybe they were practical, like if you shot an animal, you had to track it down and make sure it was dead. You couldn't leave a wounded deer out in the forest. You couldn't wound animals and not kill them. You couldn't just kill a whole bunch of animals for no particular reason. So there was, even among hunters, who you'd think be the most ambiguous about philosophy and ethics and nature, there were a lot of rules, and not all of them. For instance, hunting the animal down and making sure that it's dead, if you wounded it, doesn't seem to be a practical measure. It seems to be a moral, an ethical, honorable person does one thing. Honorable guy, no matter how much trouble he has to go through and how long he has to spend out there, follows his wounded animal down. So that seems kind of ethical even before we start talking about the philosophy of environmental ethics.
Exactly. I totally agree. And, you talk about the relationship of rules to these kinds of sentiments that somebody has. I do think that a lot of times our laws and our rules are grounded in ethics. But often we forget that they are connected to a very lived experience of ethics, a sentiment that this is right and this is wrong, the treatment of an animal should be done humanely. We often lose contact with that direct moral sentiment. And many people point out that hunters have a much more intimate connection with the animals that they're hunting than the environmentalists who may be trying to save them, because they know those animals. They've followed them and tracked them, and they have a nearness to them where they may have that closer sentiment rather than just the rule.
That's always been my experience, Matt. And I know that the pictures on the internet and whatnot of somebody next to a rhinoceros and all the other horrible things that some people do that can afford it. But in my everyday experience, certainly living in northern Arizona, hunters are the environmentalists in many, many ways. They have a much closer, hunters and fishermen anyway, and they know more about the herding and feed and how much graze is on a given section of land than certainly the people that proposed to be environmentalists.
So let me ask Matt, then I guess my question is, where does the ethics of not being cruel to animals come from? Why is there an ethical rule against being cruel to animals, against killing a bunch of animals for no particular reason, using animals for food? Where does all this, what's the ethical basis of this, or is that too broad a question?
No, I think it's a good one. I think that it's rooted, again, as I mentioned, kind of the lived experience of our encounters with nature. I think that it becomes clear when you spend much time in nature that there are certain balances there, that nature finds a balance. I think that when you're out in nature, you start to recognize that balance and that there's a rightness and a wrongness to certain types of treatments of animals. So I think that it's deeply rooted in our encounters with nature.
I want to do mention, philosophy is often lofty, and it is that framework. It's the matrix behind what it is that our behavior, at least some people think so, at least we hope so, including this environmental behavior. But one manifestation of this, which I can't even begin to pass up here, is Giuliani versus the United States. It was on 60 Minutes a couple of Sundays ago, and where these 21 plaintiffs are suing the United States and several of its executive branch positions, including at one time Donald Trump and Barack Obama. They are represented, the plaintiffs represented by the nonprofit organization called Our Children's Trust. Includes things like Earth's Gardens and on behalf of future generations, and climatologist James Henson. Some of the fossil fuel industry groups were also originally named in the suit, but were dropped by the judge's request. So the fact that this lawsuit has been able to continue, the fact that this group of legal people out of Portland are suing, and the claim is that the U.S. government, the legislative and executive branches, are incapable of saving the climate. They're incapable of controlling the fossil fuel industry, so they're asking the judicial branch to do what the legislative branch and the executive branch can't do. The lawsuit asserts that the government violated the youth's rights by allowing activities that harm the climate and sought the government to adopt methods for reducing carbon dioxide emissions. The lawsuit is at the leading edge of an area of environmental law. I'm reading from Wikipedia. Environmental law referred to as atmospheric trust litigation. I like that. Let me say that again, because that's what kind of what
we've been talking about, atmospheric trust legislation a lot, Mike.
Well, we've been talking about atmospheric trust anyway, and how this all came about, this sort of intrinsic loyalty or care that we're supposed to take for our environment. And certainly a lot of people in Sedona feel this way, that this is not just something you do. This is a visceral human right, a human need. We take care. You don't poop where you eat, you know, that sort of thing. You know, and not taking care of the environment is an emotional and yet and really important thing.
So what's the ethical basis of what Mike's talking about there, Matt?
Well, I think this is a test of the legal structures that we have right now to see if they are including the moral sentiments that we have. And I think this is historically we see this where we see the expansion of rights to include and recognize the rights of people that were not previously recognized. So we see expansions of legislation to protect these types of rights that previously we didn't recognize. And I think this is an example of this. And I think this is partly the rights of younger generations as well as future generations. And I do think this is an issue that our generations are going to be judged by the future.
So does nature have rights?
I think so.
I mean, we have a choice of two fuel plants. One is a coal-producing plant, and we don't care whether it's polluting or not. We just fire a sucker up. We rip up the ground. We do whatever we have to make it work. Another is an environmentally friendly generator of the same amount of electricity. Why should we prefer the environmentally friendly one? I mean, as a practical matter, yes, but why should we do it, I guess, distinguish between the practical side of it and the ethical side of this? Or maybe they're together. I don't know, Matt.
Well, you started by asking if nature has rights, and I don't think this particular legal case addresses nature's rights. There are other instances, especially in other countries, I believe in Colombia, where they have declared rights for the rainforest. And I don't think this is a particular case that would go to that. What you're asking about, though, with different types of fuels for extraction, what you're talking about there, I think, is one of these less harmful, both to the environment and to the people that depend on the environment. And in one case, I think you can clearly say that certain types of extraction, certain types of fuels have a greater harm for more people now, today, and in the future. And there is another alternative that's readily available to us that would cause less harm to people today and in the future. And that seems to me to be a pretty clear moral situation. If you have two alternatives, one causes more harm and another one causes less, and the one that causes less harm is readily available and not that expensive, we should probably take the one that causes less harm.
So it's based on harm, the amount of harm. You're getting an ethical basis to deal with nature based on the idea of harms being done by different things that you might do. So if you have sustainable hunting, that harms particular animals, but it doesn't harm a species, right?
Sure. I think probably most people's encounters as a hunter, you might only encounter it as harming an individual and whether you're doing the right thing there. That's the difficult thing, is moving to the level of a species, just as it is for humanity to rise to the level of thinking about humans as a whole. I think that's the big ethical challenge, because it's very easy to say, well, I come up to you and I stomp on your toe. I've just harmed you. There's a direct causal connection and I'm clearly responsible. But the idea that maybe my stomping on your toe is going to harm future generations, it's a lot harder to draw some kind
Didn't
of connection.
Didn't the extinction of animals, like on the near extinction of buffalo, the extinction of passenger pigeons, the extinction of a lot of other sort of bird species, didn't that prime interest in environmental ethics way before it became a topic? Wasn't in the late 19th, early 20th century people seeing that the buffalo basically had to be saved? They were down to a tiny group. Didn't that sort of jumpstart this, the fact people saw species disappear, whole species disappearing, and they didn't know what happened to them, or they wanted to prevent it from happening again?
Right. Well, what's interesting, I think, is the question of whether we're motivated for the intrinsic rights of those species that we're talking about, or if we are thinking of it only in terms of our enjoyment of that species. So what you're talking about, I think, in that era was largely what spurred the movement towards the national parks in the United States. But I think very much those park systems became kind of a playground for the elite and the wealthy, so that they could go and enjoy these specimens. So it still had not risen to the level of recognizing the intrinsic rights of those species, but more for their utility in the pleasure that they bring us so that we can watch them.
Well, then that's what's paralleling with this Giuliana versus the United States as the name of the case. If you're interested in it, you can look it up under that name. But the idea is that a clean environment is a fundamental right for humans. Judge Judy Aiken, we want to get her name, allowed this case to go forward in 2016. The first, you know, there's been environmental cases since the 90s, and most of them are thrown out of court. A few, and, you know, thanks to the EPA and the creation of that government body, got to create law. They've been chipping away at it ever since. But this one is fascinating. So in 2016, Judge Judy Aiken allows this case to go forward because, she said, access to a clean environment is a fundamental right, and that that the government wasn't protecting that right, at least the two branches of government. So the only branch left is the judicial branch, which shows he's appealing to that.
That's interesting. Does it actually use the term clean environment? Is it clean or dirty? Is that the terminology that they use? Because that's the terminology of pollution.
As far as I know, yeah, it uses the words clean environment as a fundamental right.
Because I think it seems to me that the case would actually hinge more on the access, not so much to a clean environment. I mean, this is the distinction that sometimes is being crossed over, is whether CO2 is a pollutant. And some people try to argue that it is not a pollutant because it itself does not actually cause kind of the dirtying of the environment. It just changes the climate. And so you have instability and unpredictability in the environment. I think that that would be a more accurate way to describe it, is it's creating climate unpredictability for the future.
Right. And rather than a pollution, so you have to, that's an interesting distinction. Well, that's what we have philosophers for, Mike. They make distinctions like this so we can help us figure out stuff.
She brought the case. It's called Our Children's Trust. It's an Oregon nonprofit. It was created by attorney Julia Olson to help formulate the kinds of things we're talking about here, to form legal cases that could be taken against states and the federal government that would somehow, at least where they were violating a public trust to have a clean environment for many groups of people.
Industry itself is, and farming, a tremendous number of farm accidents, industry, a lot of accidents and death in industry. And I set up a coal burning plant, and it doesn't hurt the particular guys. I mean, maybe some coal miners die, but it spreads pollution over an area that causes statistical damage. In other words, 1 out of 100 kids develops all kinds of asthma and stuff like that. So how do you evaluate I guess, general ethical responsibility from particular. I know, for example, it may a particular is I don't hurt a person for no reason, but I want my plant to produce an income for me and for the workers and stuff, and we build a plant and it's polluting, it's causing injury. How is that evaluated, I guess, in the spectrum of things, or is it?
Well, again, I would point out that there's two different potential harms, at least, that you're looking at when you're looking at a coal plant. The ones that you just mentioned were the harms of the pollution, the harms of the extraction, the coal miners who are breathing the dust, the water that's contaminated. So there's a direct pollution from the extraction process. But then there's the long-term intent of that coal is to burn it and put carbon into the atmosphere. That is a much less clear harm to people. People don't perceive that as directly. Now, the thing is, we have just as much trouble addressing the harm of the coal miner and recognizing their harm and their position that they can call for some kind of repair or retribution or some kind of...
We have rules. We establish rules because of the amount of miners who died. Mm-hmm. So OSHA established work rules that protect miners at least to a degree. In fact, all industries have OSHA protection, and that just means that there are rules to keep people from getting hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, in the same way in a restaurant, you have rules about cleanliness and sterilizing things and doing, there are rules just to protect the general public. But I guess my question is when the harm becomes so general, like with climate change, when it doesn't affect me personally very much, it affects everybody a little bit, that spreads the harm over such a huge number of people, places, and things that it's very hard to get any kind of action on environmental change because it, you know, in our lifetime, we may or may not see an amount of global warming, but it's certainly happening. It's a question of speed and rising waters, and the statistics go back and forth.
Well, I would say it's also a matter of paying attention to what harms really are actually occurring. The United States, it is true, globally, relative to the globe, is actually not going to be experiencing as much harm as soon as other places. But as soon as you start looking at countries already that are closer to the equator, you're starting to already see dramatic harm. Think about the refugee crisis that's unsettled Europe. Many of those refugees, you can trace the cause of their original movements to climate change. So these are much more viscerally felt harms, I think, when you see the climate refugees around the world, particularly from Central America. A lot of people, when they're talking about the immigration crisis on the border, they don't draw the connection to the drought in Central America. And so I just don't hear people making that clear connection to that.
It's also an area that's going to be radically impacted because of a lot of its low-lying, and a lot of the production of food and everything else they do is in the lower lying, not the mountainous areas. Central America is one of the most vulnerable areas, if I understand it correctly, in the world to climate change, to global warming, rising sea levels, transformations and how things are done. I guess the practical question is to move away from, I don't know that we should move away from philosophical question, but the practical question is when you talk to students, say, about harms to the climate and climate change and stuff, and you talk about ethics, what are you saying to them? I mean, what's your approach to this? I mean, I'm a young person and I have heard about climate change and stuff, but I haven't really thought about climate change. I haven't really thought about environmental ethics. I just don't want to harm stuff. I start out with just sort of an emotion without any kind of intellectual structure much for it, or not an explicit one.
Well, I think that's usually what I'm trying to work with is many of the students who come into a philosophy and an ethics class, and especially an environmental ethics class, has an intuition that there is something wrong about what we are doing in the environment. And what I do is I try to help articulate that. And one of the ways that we articulate that is trying to think about what has kept us from doing anything so far. And I think our previous institutions have kind of set us up in a particular way so that we only recognize certain types of harms. So again, what I'm trying to get at is I think the students often come in with an intuition of wrongness, and then I try to help them see how it is that our institutions have failed to address those wrongs.
I guess this is a big question, but maybe I answer just a part of it. Why do our institutions so completely fail to deal with things like environmental ethics, to deal with climate change? I mean, I know we're the only country in the world that's having a huge battle about global warming and climate change for political reasons, but I guess why are institutions, Matt, such failures? As Mike mentioned, this lawsuit. I mean, you wouldn't have to file this lawsuit if people were doing environmental justice, I guess, or something, whatever you want to call it.
Well, there's a lot of different factors, I think, that are involved. Number one, a lot of times institutions do not recognize the rights of individuals, and they have to be persuaded to recognize the rights of individuals. Another thing is we have industries that are involved in legislation in order to favor their industries. We have a side shoot of those industries that's also creating false information that's influencing people that says everything is fine, you don't need to worry about anything. And then also you have just a more general sense among people that they don't want to be worrying about things. They want to have a good time. They want to go out and go for a drive and drive across country and not have to think about things. And so this becomes motivated reasoning where we want a particular conclusion to be true so that we can keep doing things as we're doing them. One of my favorite examples is when, you know, a person has been saving up for retirement so that they can get an RV and drive around and go to the national parks. You know, it's very hard to tell that person out, sorry, you shouldn't be doing that. You're wrong. You're a bad person or anything like that because they're wanting to get in an RV and drive to visit
but
the national
really
parks.
But they really are terrible.
I don't think you should say that they are terrible for that. But it does mean that we need to be rethinking how we're doing everything.
And that's inconvenient. I mean, that was Al Gore's inconvenient truth. Mm-hmm. The problem, I guess, is it's almost people see environmentalism as a kind of nitpicking inconvenience. Now I have to recycle these damn cans instead of just throwing stuff out. Now I have to you can't use enough salt on our roads when we snow. We're using things that are less polluting. It does cause inconvenience. It causes people to be forced to change the way they're behaving. We should use cloth napkins instead of paper napkins. Well, I don't know what the issues are, but I know that a lot of people, particularly older people, experience this really sort of emotionally, Matt. They go, this is really inconvenient. I don't, exactly what you're saying. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about what I have to do. I want my big pickup truck and I want to roar around because it's a lot of fun, you know, and my ATV is also a lot of fun and my so forth and so on.
And now we're going to say that you can't even have straws for your drinks.
Right, you're taking away my straws for my Coke.
So I'm just trying to get at psychologically, this is very challenging to try to get people to think about things like this. And there's an intuitive wall there that people are going to resist. That's the big challenge. That's why I think ultimately this is a philosophical problem that more than it is a scientific problem.
Why is that true? Why is it more a philosophical problem, an ethical problem that is a scientific problem? Because I think, you know, when I was looking a little bit on environmental ethics, there's a difference between intrinsic value of something and the functional or instrumental value of something. So, are you speaking to the to the intrinsic value of things? Is there a distinction to make? So you have a bird flying through the air. Now, instrumentally, I like looking at the bird. It's pretty. Okay. But that's about it. You know, the bird flies off and does the bird have an intrinsic value? It's like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there. Suppose there's this crazy looking insect, something that we haven't even discovered yet. Does it have an intrinsic value?
Well, the thing to realize is, these values that we're talking about, I think, are ones that we as human beings impose. If you look at that bird or that insect in nature, in the state of nature, it is subject to things that are going to annihilate it. What we typically say of nature is that it is amoral, that it is lacking morality, that it just functions according to the rules of nature or the laws of nature. Whereas we start imposing values and we start saying, you know what, that bird or that insect has a right to be. It has an intrinsic value. So I think that as soon as we start bringing those values in, it's already something that's not yet present in nature or even in science.
Why does it have an intrinsic value? Why does this bird, maybe it's a small, kind of ugly-looking bird, you know, why does it have an intrinsic value? Where does its intrinsic value, now this is an impossible question, where does its intrinsic value come from? What's the origin of its intrinsic value?
Well, the thing that I'm trying to say is I think that its so-called intrinsic value is something that we're applying to it. So it comes from us because we value it. And so there becomes the rub, what if I don't value it, or I value it for food or something like that? And then we might argue that, well, no, it had a value prior to me. But it does seem to me that ultimately, when you're looking at the bird in a state of nature, you can't really judge the jaguar that kills the bird as being wrong because it's harmed the intrinsic value of the bird. It's just followed the laws of nature. So what I'm trying to say is I think that the terminology of intrinsic value is something that we are imposing after the fact.
Now that's, go ahead. I mean, that's an interesting point of view. So, no, in nature we have the laws of nature, the patterns of nature, complexity of nature. Franciscans say there are two Bibles. The first is nature and the second is the written Bible. So maybe we can learn stuff from nature. It does seem amoral, right, Mike? I mean, you know, our perception of our ancestors that it was a lot dog-eat-dog has some accuracy to it, right?
Well, that's it, the whole environmental ethics question. You know, in other words, it is so, I think, modern and yet so necessary, you know, that as time has gone on, that you just referenced, that our ancestors had to, you know, thanks to the Bible, we got dominion over everything, you know, the fowl and the fish and the environment. But because of the ethical to be applied to the environment, at least in today's time, where we see ourselves in this environmental mess, those ethics have to have changed. But I think those things change really, really slowly. And even though at the, you know, university level they can chat about it, and maybe in courts they can chat about environmental rights and wrongs and intrinsic values, but this gets difficult when you have these two. What I'm seeing, these two things come against each other: the right and wrong of a philosophical position, and the rights of a company or of workers to make a living.
The politics of it, ethics of it, and the deeper ethics of it, deep ethics of it. But there's also the politics of it.
But legal people would say, no, you can't bring a case for political reasons. There has to be real harm. Somebody has to,
correct,
or
yeah,
something has to be harmed.
Yeah. So, Matt, what do you think?
So, I just want to kind of get back to the value question and this idea of intrinsic value, and what I'm trying to get at is there is a in a area of philosophy that I work in. It's called phenomenology, which is basically the study of our perceptual experience. And what it describes is how we have a level of experience that is pre-conscious, that is prior to our conscious articulation of what it is that we're experiencing. So when I'm in my stream of experience, I'm living in my lived experience. But then when I stop and I say something about that, and I say, well, this is my experience. This is good or this is bad or something like this. I've now raised it beyond that first level of experience. And I think it is in our first level of experience and our lived experience of the natural world that we encounter this intrinsic rightness of it. But as soon as we start trying to identify this is right or this is wrong and this is why, we're raising it above the perceptual experience to the articulated conceptual experience. And that's what we're starting to get at when we're dealing with law as well. We're starting to try to bring something up to a higher level, and it's going to have different justifications for it than we're going to find in our perceptual lived experience.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's I was listening to this yesterday in a different situation, but you feel and you know something is right, but you can't necessarily, and everybody agrees that it's right. But once you try to define it, then it sort of breaks down into it not being so clear.
And that's what philosophy does, even philosophy of religion. You have a religion, you believe it, that's one thing. Philosophy of religion is to start thinking about the religion in a, as well as believe it, as well as practice it, is to think about, natural law, all of the philosophical concepts of the East and the West. I guess, Matt, I one of the questions that I guess is sort of a little bit from left field is something people don't talk about anymore is overpopulation. Is there an ethics to overpopulation? Is that an environmental ethic or not?
Excellent question. I think that's the issue we always end up going back to, is that if there were far fewer of us, we could probably live in all the ways that we like to live, all the behaviors that we would, that we're starting to talk about having to reduce and lessen our behavior. We could all be driving SUVs and eating meat, you know, without any problem if there's a lot fewer of us. One of the big problems is, people are resistant to this because it starts coming into issues of, questions of genocide historically have often come up, with regard to population control. I don't think that that's necessarily the case myself. I do think it's a bit of a slippery slope, but it is a worry that people have that as soon as you start talking about population, you're talking about population control. I think that, availability of birth control should be, you know, a technology that is currently available and in our control. It should be widely available. If a person chooses to use birth control, they should be able to have that available to them. I tend to strongly believe that our population could self-control that way, sufficiently.
Right.
Without having
a lot
any
more
kind
sense
of external
than, yeah,
control.
Exactly. That makes a lot more sense than anything else.
And I think it's
policies have been pretty horrible in China. I mean, one child per family. Mm-hmm. Then there's all the corruption that goes along with that, with having two child and hiding them with your sister. All this crazy stuff that goes on.
Well, that's it. Do these things, are these hierarchical? In other words, is it life, liberty, and the pursuit of a recreational vehicle? that life comes first in that list. Is not by accident.
My question for you, Mike, is can we do this voluntarily like Matt seems to imply, or is it something that we have to have a law? You know, I mean, first understanding that we can't overpopulate the planet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody has two kids, tops, or two or three kids because, you know, it's a thing. Or is it some sort of rule needed? Is there, even if propaganda, is it,
If
can it be done without force and violence? I guess.
If that's my question, I think we're looking at it now. I think with the right circumstances, it can be violent. I think maybe our inherent selfishness will keep it just fine. If but the condition that Matt set, that birth control has to be universally available, and the education that goes with it has to be universally available. And yes, on that basis, but that's not happening.
But, for example, the Hispanic Latino birth rate's always been high. It's been dropping now as people become more middle class and have the same economic pressures that they have in Europe and the United States, and how many kids can you put through college and all this sort of stuff.
Well, every, you know, at least in this country, every immigrant ethnic group has gone through that. You know, Italian, your wealth was in your children, or at least in your, how many you could produce and that sort of thing. But as you say, as they became more prosperous than
people from Asian countries, they want to have a lot of kids because they come from countries where there's no social security. I mean, if you don't have a kid to take care of you when you get old, you got a problem.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and then what's interesting is that there's institutions like the church, though, that are also enforcing norms around birth control. And so one of the questions is, why is it that they have an interest in this? Why is it that they have so much persuasion on this? And another thing is also, when I'm in conversations with people who are diehard rejectors or critics of the climate science, often what I find is that the argument eventually gets to a point where they say, well, yeah, this is probably going to end in famine and war and conflict, where people are going to die and populations will drop.
And they're okay with that.
And many people, it seems, are okay with that. And that seems to me the thing that we need to try to articulate. That seems to be a problem. We're talking about people suffering harm.
That's it.
The Black Plague during the Middle Ages killed, what, two-thirds or half? Let's say half. I don't remember the statistic. A third of the people in Europe. And that set off an economic boom because there was a lot less people using the land. They had more land to produce things with. And so it had a paradoxical, I think we don't like to look at things like that. The Black Plague had a paradoxically
benefit
to economic development. I mean, it's a horrible idea, but that it seems to have been true.
Well, and what we're often referring to in this way is the balances that nature finds. We see this in nature. We were talking about this earlier. And if we become more sensitive to that, we can perhaps guide our societies more in accord with that rather than forcing our societies to get to that level of harm. Because I think we recognize that that's wrong. Yeah, for us to get the benefit of these people that are dying, for example, right? Mm-hmm. As a higher civilization, we start to recognize that, you know, sure, the state of nature could be rebalanced, but we need to do what's right instead.
Well, the environmental ethical conundrum, well, at least I still see it as a conundrum, will have to be put on hold. As the case Giuliani versus the United States, by the way, is on hold at the moment, because we're almost out of time, folks. I don't know how to sum up.
So we're going to be put on hold till next week.
We're going to be put on hold for another week. That's right. Democratic perspective is.
We want to thank Matt for being with us. I mean, I think it's important, Mike, to talk about these background issues. This is what young people are talking about.
Well, one of the things that
I think it's important to think about. It's like political philosophy as well as doing politics. You know,
I think it's one of the things Democratic perspective likes. We like that perspective. We like to see what's behind the decision making process. Don't forget, folks, we have. We do have a donate button on our website, by the way. I get complaints from our people, Steve, that we don't ask for money enough. So we're going to spend a couple of seconds asking for money. We do have a donate button at the Verde Valley Independent Democrat.org website. VVID.org works on my phone. It doesn't work on everybody's. VVID.org. You can donate. You want to see things like Democratic perspective stay on the air. We talk about the Yavapai College thing. We talk about Overhaul Grande. We talk about our community involvement. That's somebody reminded. Actually, a government official reminding me how important democratic perspective is as far as what we do in and for the community. Please don't forget our good friends at Democrats of the Red Rocks who have been helping us out. And listen to this podcast. This on our website, vbid.org, has this podcast.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.